There's not a CEO or an M&A team in a strategic environment, and certainly not in the PE world, that's not just gearing up for a much more expansive deal environment in 2024. And so there's a lot of discussions about capabilities. There's a lot of discussions about how do you prepare your engine for a higher degree of uncertainty geopolitically? How do you ensure that we have the capital and the dry powder to be able to act on high-priced assets, et cetera? So a great deal of discussions about the habits of successful acquirers and what we can learn.
From McKinsey & Company, I'm Sean Brown, and welcome to Inside the Strategy Room. That was Jake Henry, a senior partner in our Chicago office, setting up our discussion today about mergers and acquisitions, or M&A. Jake and his colleagues recently released the report, The Top M&A Trends in 2024, which offers a blueprint for success in the next wave of deal-making. Today, we're going to discuss some of the report's findings and what they mean for business leaders. Now, let me introduce our guests. Jake is the global co-leader of our M&A practice and previously co-led our life sciences practice. Jake, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Sean, and good to be with everyone.
Mika van Oostender is a senior partner in our Brussels office. She co-leads our M&A practice with Jake and serves clients on M&A strategy, due diligence, integrations, and separations. She's also a global leader in our banking practice. Mika, it's great to have you with us.
Thanks a lot, Sean, and greetings from Amsterdam, and great to be here.
And finally, we're joined by Andy West, a senior partner in our Boston office. Andy co-leads our strategy and corporate finance practice. He counsels senior leaders across the industrial, high-tech, and healthcare sectors on all aspects of strategy and execution, including M&A. And he previously co-led our M&A practice. Andy, welcome.
Thanks, Sean. Hello, everyone from Boston.
Really excited to speak with you all today. So let's start with a little bit of background on this new annual report. What does the report cover and who should read it?
Yeah, the report discusses a number of things. There are a number of more cross-functional themes, I would say, which are relevant for everybody. How do you reflect on culture already during a due diligence? What is the relevance of a portfolio strategy? How do you engage an organization during the always increasing regulatory approval and timelines? But we also discuss the 2022 events and what does it mean for the 2024 outlook. We have a deep dive on Asia, and we have also a deep dive on a number of sectors where we also look at what has happened over 2023 and where we try to describe a number of trends going forward.
Thanks, Mika. Now, we all know the last few years have seen some challenges in overall M&A activity. What would be the top headlines on where things are going? Jake?
Well, thanks, Sean. Maybe before we start, let's just back up a half step and see where we've come from. If you look at 2023, I think we actually hit the lowest level of deals ever in the S&P. And it's pretty extraordinary to actually see that data, which tends to suggest that last summer, most M&A executives actually took the summer off. And if you ask the cafe leaders in the Cape in Boston, I think you saw an inordinate number of them that were actually housing private equity executives as opposed to their normal members of the tennis set. So it was quite a tremendous year last year in terms of the depths to which we hit in total deal volume. And I think that what you saw more than anything was that the macroeconomic shifts, the lack of board conviction around deal theses and challenges in the geopolitical environment actually led to a terrible level of M&A. In the Americas, actually at the middle point of the year, I think we were down almost 37% in total deal volume in 2023, which is an extraordinary number. And we saw the same trends actually in Europe and in Asia. And if you think then about the environment that we were experiencing at that point, there were a lot of people asking the fundamental question of, is M&A dead? But you actually did see again in the Q4 quite a dramatic uptick in the level of activity that was led by a number of sectors that we'll talk about specifically later, in TMT, life sciences, financial services, et cetera. So at the midpoint of last year, we were actually over 50% down from the 2021 peaks and 37% down from the 22 decline. So, you know, M&A last year was really challenged. And I think that you will see that M&A, though, is on a trajectory upwards.
Thanks, Sheikh. But it still seems that companies are sitting on the sidelines. So let's get back to that big question you alluded to earlier. Is M&A dead?
I think we would say profoundly no. And the fundamental reason is that we believe that M&A remains a principal portion of corporate strategy. And those companies that do invest in M&A do continue to outperform those who don't from an organic perspective. We'll show you some data on that in a couple of minutes. But why do we think that M&A could actually see a rebound in 2024? The first is the macro environment is really stabilizing. And when you speak to executives, I think what you hear more than anything from these executives is positive outlook. We noted that Goldman Sachs actually changed, you know, its probability of a recession from 60% down to 30%. And when you talk to M&A professionals, when you talk to CEOs, when you listen to their quarterly results, you hear a level of positivity that hasn't been there in years. And the prospect of a soft landing, continued consumer spending, the stabilization and potential outlook in interest rates with central bankers, actually believing that you could see even a reduction in the overall level of interest rates, certainly points to a more positive macroeconomic environment. And certainly at the same time, the markets are following suit. And with those valuations stabilizing, the environment for executives to be able to get deals done and the willingness of boards to consider deals is quite a bit higher. There's a tremendous amount of dry powder in the system. You know, if the private equity executives were hanging out in the internet cafes on the vineyard in the last summer, they now have built up over $2 trillion in dry powder across private equity firms and undeployed capital. There's over $3 trillion on Fortune 500 balance sheets today. So with that live level of dry powder, you're certainly going to see executives looking to deploy it. And of course, we've written many times in the past the benefit of pursuing M&A versus those of dividends or share buybacks. There's quite a bit of excitement across the regions. North America in particular is viewed as an economy that is on the rise. There have been some dramatic shifts in terms of capital, with capital leaving and its focus on China in the Asia region. You see increasing investment in India and the ASEAN markets, with a lot of belief in the supply chains that are required and a lot of recognition of the globalization of those companies. And you even saw Europe rebound at the end of last year as well. And there's a lot of regulatory incentives in place right now that will fuel M&A, particularly in a cross-border direction. And then the last factor is around the proliferation of deal rationales, if we use, you know, a bit of a consulting term there. But, you know, what we're seeing is people are using M&A for different things than they have been in the past, where, you know, many theses were based around the idea of achieving scale. We're now seeing access to capabilities, and we're starting to see the access to additional services to surround core product positions really take off. So many real reasons to believe that 2024 could actually see a pretty dramatic uptick as that dry powder starts to return into the marketplace.
Thank you. So another question that's on a lot of people's minds is related to the continued geopolitical uncertainty and some of the national elections that are coming up later this year, including in the U.S. What impact do you expect these to have on companies' interest in doing deals now and going forward?
It's very fair, and we try not to comment on the political environment too much, but you know, what we can say is the following. In an election year, there's often an economic bump, and you know, with either the continuation or a change in, particularly in North America and in the U.S. around the presidential administration, and not saying it'll go one way or the other, but there's often a belief and a level of positivity that comes with that. You know, there's also the regulatory aspects that are associated with that. And we've shown some data in the report that suggests that regulatory timelines in the U.S. and in the Eurozone in particular have been lengthened by almost 50%. And you also see a 50% higher likelihood of a deeper dig into the regulatory aspects of particular deals. should that change, I think you would see potentially a shift in the willingness of companies to do deals and the aggressiveness of some of the theses. But certainly any geopolitical uncertainty certainly does affect deal theses, creates a higher bar often for returns.
So let's get a little bit deeper into the factors that might drive this potential M&A rebound. Perhaps we can start with the dry powder that Jake mentioned earlier. Andy, who has this dry powder, and what do we think will increase folks' willingness to actually use it?
I mean, when you think about tailwinds and what's actually happening, we look at private equity. I mean, you look at the deal volume, some of the data that Jake showed, and you see the drop in deal volume, what you'll see is a pretty pronounced drop in private equity, relatively speaking, from a very active environment to one that's been much, much more muted. Now, obviously, the fact that the money is out there and it's ready to deploy and it's growing from a dry powder perspective, I think it only increases our overall kind of bullishness that there is capital out there. And if we can, you know, if it can find a match, I think people are ready to put it to work. So, you know, we continue to be a bit optimistic on what's likely to happen, at least from a private equity perspective.
You know, in the Americas, if you look at where the deal flow came from, you know, in 2023, obviously PE deals were down exponentially. And if you talk to private equity executives right now, you know, the hold periods that they have now reached in their funds have exceeded anything in the recent two decades. You have funds that have assets that have been in the portfolio 6-7 years and funds that have not transacted on a single exit to this point. And that's reflected in the level of the PE-led deals that we saw, which were less than 20% of those by value in 2023. Mika?
Yes. And so also in EMEA, we see a similar trend. Maybe actually PE coming from an even higher level in 2021. We were close to 40%, between the 35 and 40%. That came down quite significantly at the beginning of 2023 and is now kind of restoring itself again. I think in the US a bit faster than in Europe. In the US, they probably all came back from their vineyards end of August. And that's when we started to see all the deals being announced, or at least an increase in the deals being announced. It may have followed a bit later in the October, December timeframe.
Interesting. So what about cross-border deals? Are those also increasing? And if so, where do we see those most ramping up?
Now, indeed, what is interesting to see is that we see for some geographies, a quite interesting increase in the cross-continental flows, right? We see an increased investment from EMEA in Americas, but we see especially an increased investment from the Americas in the other regions, in both EMEA from 13 to 16%, and also APAC from, I believe, 6 to 11%. So I would say money is increasingly flowing around. Let's see if that will also continue for 2024.
And what that feels like in the boardroom and with the CEOs is, you know, a lot of discussions about globalization and a lot of discussions about the global supply chain that they need, the capabilities they need, but certainly a lot of executives looking to understand where their global growth prospects actually exist and an increasing willingness to access that growth through the acquisition of capabilities and footprint in those geographies.
So as some of you alluded to, the economic picture in some European countries might not be quite as healthy as that in North America. What impact do you see that economic situation having on the M&A landscape there, and specifically some of the cross-border deal flow?
Yeah, it's fair to say that Europe did maybe not go as deep as the US in the beginning of 2023. But it's also fair to say that Europe takes a longer time to restore. And although we had a kind of normal Q4, to be honest, the jury is still out there, right? And so we do see corporates being much more prudent and waiting a bit on what will happen from economic perspective, but also geopolitical perspective, as we also are in a number of transitions over here in Europe. On the other hand side, to give maybe a spark of optimism, is I do see a lot of executives accepting kind of the volatile environment and accepting it almost as a new normal, and realizing that they will not be able to realize their corporate strategy only with organic growth. And so hence, I see many corporates, again, engaging in kind of what do we need to do from an M&A perspective and engaging, re-engaging in M&A dialogues. They might be more prudent, but you do see the number of discussions along the full value chain. And when you talk to lawyers, when you talk to investment bankers, truly picking up.
That's great, Mika. Thank you. And we've also been seeing more antitrust scrutiny and longer regulatory approvals. Jake, could that be another countervailing factor that might be moderating the current levels of M&A activity?
Well, yeah, I think it's about the duration of reviews, the likelihood of a secondary review across regulatory agencies. And when you talk to executives, I think they do view this as the new normal, and they're preparing in many ways to be able to surround themselves with the right advisors to be able to make it through those review processes. They're preparing for a long duration to close in many deals. But I do also sense that business leaders are also increasingly willing to contest regulatory action and to ensure that the business fundamentals that they believe should come about actually do.
Yeah, Jake, I would say the track record of deals that are getting much more scrutiny is starting to become a bit more transparent. And I think while deals are taking longer, they're still going through in many, many cases. And so I think at least what I'm seeing, and this is, again, before the data hits the market, I think that's just a recognition that it may take a bit longer, which obviously adds some level of uncertainty, both for the organizations, but then also for the outcome. That uncertainty may not be as high as folks thought, which is at least leading to some thawing here in the United States.
Got it. Thank you. So could you comment on the relationship between the increase in dry powder and current multiples? Because as multiples go up, you know, deal makers will need to therefore raise more money for a given deal and use more dry powder.
Yeah, I think there's a number of interesting points to be able to make there. You know, in 2023, on a normalized to the S&P, we hit the lowest level of deal value and the lowest level of transactions in three decades, which, you know, of course, provoked this question of, is M&A dead? The other point to make is we've never seen that relationship that close where, you know, the undeployed capital in the private capital markets is even starting to approach the level of dry powder in the Fortune 500. Now, with the S&P reaching a maximum, you are correct that you're going to need to see more powder deployed, Sean. You know, when you look at the industries in which you're seeing investment, which are trending right now towards energy and materials, TMT in the tech world, and financial services in particular, and of course, healthcare is always in the top four there. When you look at those industries and you consider what each of them is trying to access, you know, you are seeing very pricey valuations in some of these sectors. So in the energy and material space, brown to green transition, high-priced green assets with a lot of expectations certainly are valued at a very high level. In TMT, anything to do with AI, where people are trying to access capabilities that are rapidly emerging, those are two areas where you're seeing the need to deploy more capital. At the same time, when you look at the other two, where you've got healthcare and financial services is being driven, at least in North America, by some of the changing regulatory requirements and the continued challenges around regional banks, different views about the scale that is required to compete in areas like credit. And then in healthcare, you're seeing a need to be able to access biotech assets to continue to drive the overall growth and revenue. So some areas where increased capital will be required, some areas where the benefits of scale and the accessibility of some of the growth assets are actually more doable at this stage. I don't know, Andy, Mika, what would you build on there?
I do feel like, you know, multiples are as a function of supply and demand, right? And outlook and market outlook. And one thing that's actually interesting over the last few years, you just highlighted it, is there are overlapping value propositions. And we're seeing a real spike in capability-led M&A, right? And people seeking capabilities. And a lot of those are overlapping. Technology is overlapping for almost every sector. You know, the green transition is actually affecting, as Jake mentioned, energy and materials, but a lot of sectors, right? Because there's a massive amount of capital that's going to need to flow in to afford that or affect that transition. Demographics, that's happening globally, and it's acute in some areas more than others. Certainly, that's affecting many facets of healthcare because we have an aging population, but it's affecting all parts of the value chain. So, you know, you'll see, I think, multiples going up and being acute in some areas and staying high. And that's just a function of, I think, a lot of sectors looking to build capabilities in adjacencies.
So are you seeing any new or different rationales for M&A activity? And if so, why are they coming up now and how might they be affecting the M&A market more broadly?
Yeah, one of the things we've seen from dealmakers across industries is a shift in how they're using M&A. And M&A is traditionally thought of course, to focus really on consolidation, scale building, global access, et cetera. And in a recent survey, we found that actually the two greatest theses here in TMT and advanced industries and financial services have actually gone to acquire new capabilities. And I think that's really a reflection of some of the challenges that these industries face in accessing, you know, these new disruptive innovations, either be it green brown, be it AI, be it even advanced analytics and digital assets. And the second is also quite interesting, which is this focus on services with the expansion of service offerings to surround products, where people are realizing that the ecosystem which they participate in and the value pools that surround many of their core positions actually offer tremendous growth potential. So these growth-oriented theses, as opposed to the traditional consolidating and scale-based theses, does represent a shift in the last 5 years in terms of deal rationale. You know, what's also striking is the number of deals to enter new geographies. Now, we talked about cross-border deals before and the continued expansion of globalization, but at the same time, you know, a lot of the deals in the BRICIT era, if we think about the aughts and the early 10s, when we had companies that were really using acquisitions to be able to enter China, India, Russia, Brazil, you know, those were very prevalent. Now, of course, you see it as much smaller. Now that's reflective of the actions that many companies have taken over time, but it's also reflective of the reality that continuing to double down on many of those geographies through, you know, M&A is also declining in terms of its prevalence.
Awesome. Thank you. So we talked a little bit about the reasons for some of the bullishness that we're seeing and feeling and the different factors that could be driving the uptick in M&A. What about some of the potential constraints or countervailing factors? What do you think could hold M&A back in 2024? Andy, you want to take that?
Yeah, I think it's on everyone's mind. M&A, it's a function of uncertainty, right? Because M&A requires, in a lot of ways, uncertainty will ultimately expand the M&A pie because uncertainty requires typically some sort of shock, which requires some sort of pivot in your strategy, which most companies will struggle to do organically. And that's certainly a trend we've seen for over a decade now, that ratio increasing. So exogenous shocks actually in some ways instigate M&A, but you know, M&A is a matchmaking process and evaluations are uncertain. If the impact of those shocks are uncertain, if how the impact of those shocks are actually going to affect your business is uncertain. It's hard. It's hard for organizations to decide at scale to commit a reasonable amount of capital to deal making. So in short, uncertainty will constrain in 2024. I don't think forever. I think that's actually impossible for modern companies to actually build everything they need to compete going forward. But certainly you can wait. You can wait until you know exactly how what's happening in the world is going to affect you so you can make better decisions. And whether that's geopolitical risk, whether that's regulatory risk continuing to play itself out with elections coming through and a change in regime around the world, many, many elections happening, that could slow things down.
Understood and understandable. In light of this potential and existing uncertainty, what are some of the benefits or the contrarian view to making acquisitions during such times? With many companies on the sidelines, perhaps that presents an opportunity for those enough who are bold enough to make the bet to win the prize. Mika, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'm happy to take that one. It's actually a true passion of mine. I think our research, I think already 20 years ago about when I entered the firm on granularity of growth actually showed that growth is truly crucial for survival. You cannot shrink to glory. And within that, we have also seen that relying purely on organic growth is also value destroying. It's truly a mix of organic growth and inorganic growth. And within the inorganic growth, we have also seen that the more you do it, the better you get at it, which kind of sounds very obvious, right? But our research on programmatic M&A has shown that when you do a minimum number of acquisitions a year, it's roughly around two, which our research shows also that you're realizing an excess TSR, excess total shareholder return compared to your non-programmatic colleagues. The two acquisitions a year or two to three a year need to represent a meaningful part of your market cap or your total company value. It needs to move the needle over time. It cannot be the extremely small acquisitions alone. We have also seen that successful acquirers, they do take a through the cycle view. They do not only acquire during when times are good and positive and the economy is up, but they also take it through the cycle view when the economy is down. And we see years later that the gap between those colleagues and the non-programmatic colleagues, or those who are acquiring at a certain level of frequency and those who are not acquiring, that the gap is widening. So it does make sense and it does pay off to do M&A also during economic lower cycles and during times of uncertainty.
So given all this, that clearly many factors to consider, what do you see your clients doing right now on the M&A front, and where are you seeing their priorities?
But the first is, I think there's not a CEO or an M&A team in a strategic environment, and certainly not in the PE world, that's not just gearing up for a much more expansive deal environment in 2024. And so there's a lot of discussions about capabilities. There's a lot of discussions about how do you prepare your engine for a higher degree of uncertainty geopolitically? You know, how do you ensure that we have the capital and the dry powder to be able to act on high-priced assets, et cetera? So a great deal of discussions about the habits of successful acquirers and what we can learn. You know, only 20% of companies out there are programmatic, as Mika was just describing a few minutes ago, in terms of doing deals consistently, which means 80% of companies are rusty in their capabilities. So the first is really, how do they embrace the habits of successful acquirers? The second's around portfolio management. We're big believers in active portfolio management. Those who do not only use acquisition to be able to expand it, but also divestiture and exits to be able to, and separations to be able to rotate their portfolio, do outperform those who don't. And so a lot of CEOs and boards looking at the composition of their portfolio and saying, is it what they need to be able to support the next 5 and 10 years of aspiration? The third is to orient their teams and their executives, and many CEOs do a lot of work through their divisions and their business units to be able to find and action assets. And so being able to educate them on the different deal types and how to make those deals successful is a critical discussion that we're hearing in the executive suite. Transact to transform is a very progressive idea at the moment, which is how do you use M&A to be able to trigger a broader transformation in your business? And often an M&A, an acquisition, is a seminal event for a company in changing its growth strategy and its growth direction. And at that moment, there's an opportunity, and we're seeing more companies embrace it to be able to transform the core of their business in addition to just pursuing the integration and the value capture that's available. And the last, of course, is around this green M&A theme. And as Andy said before, this is a theme that is actually propagating not just in the energy sector where it's very prevalent, but across a number of different industries. And it is very prevalent, particularly in Europe, as many businesses set net zero aspirations.
Got it. Thank you, Jake. So, Mika, what research do you have that suggests companies' M&A capabilities are perhaps becoming rusty, to the point that Jake made earlier?
Over the last, I would say, 12 to 24 months, we have received quite a lot of requests from companies who say, like, look, we want to re-engage or actually intensify our M&A. We also realize that we will not only do the more traditional consolidation deals, but also buy new capabilities, enter into new markets, which also comes with a further, I would say, maturing of the M&A capabilities. And so our M&A Capability Index, which is a database of more than 745 respondents, roughly 500 companies, indicated the following. So we asked those executives, to which extent do you feel confident in your own capabilities along each of those steps of the M&A value chain, starting from pre-diligence to diligence to integration planning and execution, and de facto that's also separation planning and execution, and to which extent do you feel you have the appropriate M&A operating model? And what we hear in conversations is that companies feel okay, comfortable, I would say upstream, in terms of the M&A strategy and blueprint, in terms of the proactive sourcing, in executing on the due diligence and then the actual transaction, but that they feel much less comfortable on the integration planning and execution. And in the end, that is where the real value is being created. If you define the price on the in the due diligence, but you need to reap the benefits during your integration execution. And so that brings me to what can we learn from successful acquirers? How do they look at their M&A capability? And so I've identified eight habits. I will not go deep in each of them. Some of them we will discuss later on, but maybe a few thoughts. On the first one, this notion on doubling down on a successful M&A strategy, making sure that it's a comprehensive strategy, not just an epilogue or an aftermath to the corporate strategy. We see that successful acquirers are three times more likely to reallocate capital to those M&A strategies which are truly accelerating their corporate strategy. And they're also able to build strong conviction with their C-suite colleagues. And that's maybe a question you can ask your colleagues later this afternoon or tomorrow morning, a kind of what is our M&A strategy? And of course, the stress test is getting hopefully consistent answers from your colleagues. Maybe the notion on do not window shop is successful acquirers are truly able to kind of identify the type of capabilities they will need to build inorganically and the type of companies they would like to engage with. They also engage proactively with those companies. They do not wait until something passes by or until they become available. And this notion of recognizing the value of people. In every integration, we will look at people selection, people retention. But if we're honest, that only addresses a reasonably small group of people, maybe 5 to 10% of the organization. You still have 90% of people left in the organization where there's not always a sufficient engagement level. And so successful acquirers will also engage very proactively with the colleagues, explain what's happening, what's the process to come, and on what will be the impact on them as an employee, as a colleague. And it does pay off, right? They do outperform their peers. And in general, programmatic acquirers outperform their peers by 2 percentage points excess TSR per annum, which is not negligible. And I think the other very important element is that they get also an uptick from a multiple uplift.
So taking a look now at the other side of the coin, how big a role does being good at divestitures play in being a successful acquirer? And Andy, maybe you could talk about that in the broader context of managing one's portfolio.
Yeah, what a great question. So we spend a lot of time looking at portfolio. And largely, when you think about the principles of strategy, where you play matters a lot. And in fact, it's probably the strongest marker of your overall economic performance in the medium to long term. So if you think about M&A as a tool to execute portfolio, the purpose is to move towards value pools that are growing and in industries and industry segments that are actually quite healthy, right? And we think from a first principles perspective, that's really important. The data continues to show up. We continue to do a lot of research on portfolio. And obviously, M&A is an incredibly powerful tool to actually pursue your portfolio. Now, a big part of portfolio is divestiture. And you need to actually be able to buy and sell assets at a rate that is meaningful to allow you to churn your portfolio. Now, why do we care? That seems obvious. Because what happens, particularly with divestitures, but when you're looking at portfolio, is two things. One, there is a massive amount of bias. When we talk about strategy at McKinsey, we talk about all of the things that compose strategy, and humans are at the core of that. Unfortunately, we're wired towards bias, confirmation bias, recency bias, sunk cost fallacy. All of these things keep us from having honest conversations about what's in our portfolio today and what we need to get rid of, largely, in order to move forward in a way that's as effective as possible. The second thing is self-awareness. Well, unfortunately, most organizations, it's true, you have a good sense of what your competitive advantage is. But if I go and I talk to 8 executives and I ask that simple question, I usually get at least 3 different, very strong answers, right? Like, yeah, it's our talent, it's our people, it's our supply chain. They're not wrong, but it's hard to act, right? If you're not being brutally honest about what you have and what's scalable. So it is really important to be brutally honest about your portfolio when buying and selling so you can move with purpose. The other thing I would say is around rotating the portfolio and steering the portfolio and managing it with KPIs. Executing on your portfolio is hard. It's really, really hard. Strategy process, budgets are not typically set up for long-term investment decisions, right? So the questions that you need to ask yourself around portfolio are, do you have a clear sense of how I'm adding value in the medium to long term? Am I able to track impact? Am I promoting action? Because talking about your portfolio and actually acting on it are very, very different things. Companies are pretty good about talking about it on average, not as great as acting on it, as I said originally. It's actually quite important when you look at performance over the long run.
Indeed. And on Jake's earlier point about proficiency in doing different types and sizes of deals, what do the best acquirers do that others listening can learn from?
First, there's a certain frequency of acquisitions, and those acquisitions do represent a material part of their total market cap or value. As Andy also said, it needs to move the needle, and where you play is an extremely important decision to take. These programmatic acquirers are also very good in selectively including larger deals, strategic deals, to kind of really give it a boost or an acceleration in terms of growth, technology development, specific talent to hire. What is also, together with this notion of shifting the portfolio, they invest 2/3 of their capital in adjacencies and step outs. So step outs are actually acquisitions outside of your own sector, and versus only 1/3 in the core. As Andy also said, they do not only invest, but they also divest in a very systematic way. And they also experiment not only with pure acquisitions, but they also have JVs and alliances. We have seen a doubling of those JVs and alliances over the last couple of years. These are also very much the ecosystems play. When you, for instance, look at the financial services sector in the early 2010s, banks were still very much acquiring fintechs. We also know that did not necessarily land or end in a great place. And we see as of the mid-2020, kind of different forms of structures being popping up. And what is more important is actually the deal rationales of these partnerships. That there where you did in the early days, a JV just to reduce costs and risks and to a certain extent reach scale together. It's now, again, much more about capabilities, combining infrastructure and other capabilities, accessing new geographies, combining IP and technology, so R&D type of capacity. So that is the notion on being proficient in multiple deal type sizes and structures.
Thank you, Mika. So now I'd love to pick up on the theme of transacting to transform. Most mergers will entail some degree of transformation, but I think what you mean is something much broader and more ambitious.
It's our true conviction that successful acquirers, when they do an acquisition, they do an acquisition because they believe that a combination can do more together than what each of the individual companies could do before. And they do not only look at combinational synergies, but they also look at transformational synergies. They also take a longer time horizon. They look, of course, at costs. I would say costs are table stakes, but they very much look at revenues, and they also look at a combined investment, I would say, pot, and so how to realize a bigger ROE out of that. And maybe a few numbers. If you look at the excess TSR these acquirers realize, 60%, when you decompose it, 60% is coming from revenue synergies versus 20% only from cost synergies. These acquirers are also able to realize their integration at the budgeted integration cost, and this is typically lower than what their other colleagues are doing. That also makes that these acquirers can pay a higher multiple compared to their other colleagues because they're able to kind of realize more value out of it, and that at a lower integration cost. One area to get inspiration from, and it's not apples to apples, it's just to get out, to push our thinking, I would say, it's actually looking at when a PE is doing an acquisition. And of course, when they do an acquisition, most of the time they don't have the complexity of an integration. Most of the time they can also not leverage the combinational synergies. So what do they do to push the value creation or to increase the value creation? And so we see three big themes popping up, which could be relevant also in more corporate acquisitions. It is notion of employing tactical levers early on in a more robust way, for instance, pricing. We see PEs looking much more quickly at the underlying assets and reflecting on which of all of these underlying assets do we need to keep, potentially do we need to strengthen with an add-on deal, or do we need to potentially divest? And they also much more quickly launch transformational programs. Now, again, I fully realize that when you need to also do an integration, it's not always that straightforward. But one could reflect on where could you selectively already very early on launch transformational programs, such in procurement or Salesforce effectiveness or operational excellence.
And so what about green deals? First, maybe you could take us through how one defines them. And then are you seeing them increase? And maybe how should companies approach actually engaging in them?
We define a green deal as a sustainability linked deal. And it's a deal which is still a way to stimulate growth and or improve your operations, but you're also improving or raising your ESG profile. We have seen our analysis has shown that these type of deals has increased by 66% since 2013 from 5% to 9%. And now we also see that those deals on average do deliver a higher TSR, but there's also a huge variation going from actually a negative TSR to a very positive TSR. And there are two reasons why that is. First of all, you need to do a green deal with a very specific deal rationale. Doing green for the sake of green is not making sense. And then secondly, most of these deals are truly capability building deals and growth deals where revenue synergies are very important. And that comes with a number of very specific requirements in your integration approach.
Thanks, Mika. So before we close, I'd love to hear your personal takeaways from the report and maybe share what you're most excited about or what gives you reason for optimism. Jake?
Well, you know, I think North America growth and increased investment in these cross-border deals, truly is a trend that, we'll see more and more acquisitive companies in North America and those looking to participate. So I think the optimism in North America is pretty exciting.
Awesome. Thank you, Jake. Mika?
I hope that some of this optimism further kind of cascades or drips through, or whatever the right word is, in Europe to kind of, I would say, further build a number of European leaders and to further increase the competitiveness of our region. It's also a personal wish. Let's say it like that.
Thank you, Mika. And Andy, you get the last word.
I'm very excited about the unthawing. There are a lot of strategies that have stalled just because of uncertainty in the market. And I think letting companies get on doing what they do best and doing it through M&A is going to be it's going to be great for productivity and good for the economy, I'm hoping, in 2024.
Jake, Mika, Andy, this was a fantastic conversation. Really appreciate you taking the time with us today. And I am certainly excited for the potential direction of M&A in 2024. And I'm sure our listeners are now too.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you. Thanks, Sean.
And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us today. As I said before, we'll include a link to the M&A report in the show notes so you can explore all of the findings. And if you'd like to share feedback or an idea for a future podcast, just email us at itsr@mckinsey.com. Again, that stands for Inside the Strategy Room. You can also share your ratings and reviews on your favorite podcast player, with many thanks to everyone who's already done so. We really appreciate all the comments and suggestions and feedback. Please do keep them coming. And if you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to subscribe, you can follow us on your favorite podcast player, where you can also access our entire library of more than 200 previous episodes. We also offer an Inside the Strategy Room podcast collection page available at mckinsey.com/ITSR. And there you can easily browse our prior podcasts across six major themes and also access written transcripts of all of those conversations. Finally, if you'd like to receive alerts on our latest publications and insights, we encourage you to sign up on our insights page at mckinsey.com/SCF. That's for Strategy and Corporate Finance. Or connect with us on LinkedIn at the McKinsey Strategy and Corporate Finance Practice page. Thanks again for listening. We look forward to having you join us again next week Inside the Strategy Room.